The plaster bandages that have been used to make casts for broken arms and legs are the material George Segal has used to make his life-size sculptures of people. He has wrapped his friends, family, and other models in these bandages to create plaster cast sculptures. He's always insisted his models remain in casual poses that would create believable art. He's often placed these plaster casts in larger sculptures that recreate real environments such as a butcher shop, dry cleaner, diner, and bus. Many of Segal's plaster sculptures have a ghostly presence because he's left the white plaster surfaces unpainted. His work from the 50s through 90s is collected in his first major exhibition in North America in 20 years. It's now at the Jewish Museum in New York. The curator of this traveling show, Marco Livingstone, writes, "By sensing the miraculous in the everyday, Segal hints at a metaphysical transcendence." I asked George Segal to describe the style of casting he developed.
By using this plaster of Paris bandage in thin layers, I'd have a model stand or sit or lie according to some idea or image I had in my head, and I'd cover their bodies in small chunks and then have to reassemble them to recreate the gesture. And I was more interested in the gesture or the essence of the movement as it was revealed by how they stood or sat.
So you'd use the same kind of material that a doctor would use who was making a cast for a broken arm?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you would do like an arm and then another arm and then a leg and then the torso and then assemble the whole thing together.
Yeah, remember Dr. Goldfinger? They killed the girl by painting her with gold paint.
Right. Yeah. So, you didn't want to be in that position.
It's embarrassing.
Did you make any mistakes before you knew what you could get away with?
No, sure did. I got some free samples of this stuff, and I was offered $75 to write a pamphlet for using material for children's projects. I had my wife cover me from head to foot, and I was nude sitting in a chair. It was hot summertime. I had no idea that plaster sticks to hair. And it did.
Ouch.
My wife couldn't get it off.
What'd you finally do?
I stood up and I tore it off. It was like taking a giant Band-Aid, a very large Band-Aid off your body. But I was so intrigued, I put it all together, despite the sadomasochism involved.
So did your models have to shave before?
No. I discovered things like Vaseline that solved the problem.
Well, how would you get the kind of pose you were looking for? How would you even find the right model for the piece that you were going to do? Say it's a piece of, you know, like a diner at the counter of a restaurant, or you know, the lady in the dry cleaning store.
I honestly can't tell you where the ideas come from. While I'm walking city streets, I can see something that will strike me, if it makes a vivid image in my head, I'll have to work a long time rebuilding that chunk of it that intrigued me. So I started using family and friends, you know, people whom I could convince that I was not going to kill. people who would trust the fact that I would, hopefully I'm not a sex maniac, and could be reassured that I would not take advantage of them while they were while I was waiting for plaster to dry. Simple stuff like that. It had to be people who essentially trusted the seriousness of my intentions.
Now, the standard way of casting in art is to make a mold and then pour a liquid material or a molten material into the mold that will then harden in the shape of the model.
True.
But that's not what you're doing. You weren't using the plaster cast as a mold to pour the liquid into. You were using that as for its outside, for its surface qualities, which isn't traditionally what's done with a plaster cast mold. Tell me why you decided to use the outside as opposed to using the inside to cast.
I was interested, as I said before, in trapping the gesture. And in recent years, I have been using the inside of the cast. But that's, well, the euphemism is I'm becoming aware of my middle age. If I look at my fingers or I look at my face in a mirror, I'm horrified. I'm horrified at the wrinkling of the skin that gets more and more pronounced every month. And then I'm intrigued at the rhythm of this increasing network, both on my face and my hands. And I start looking, all right, it's called middle age. And I'm not a kid anymore, and everybody in my generation is aging in their own fashion. And I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued with how we change, what the aging process is, and how it affects our thinking and our attitudes toward everything we know.
So how are you trying to capture that in your art? Because the kind of plaster cast that you did early on wouldn't, for instance, get the wrinkles on the face.
Say I make the same plaster cast. If I turn it over and look at the inside, there's a reproduction of all those wrinkles that intrigue me so deeply. And I simply put some separator in there, pour plaster into it, or the same bandages, and I can make a cast that's quite realistic. Realism is a very strange term. It's incredibly simple technically to make a cast that's increasingly realistic. The only reason I continue to cast from people is the uncanny ability of the plaster to reveal inner attitudes, what attitudes my models have. Otherwise, I'd been bored years ago and have completely dropped it.
You say inner attitudes, you mean that, like, the body, the bones of a body just reveal things about a person that the plaster can capture?
Oh, indeed, yes. For myself, it's quite vivid.
I want to get back to the work that you're doing now. You were saying how both horrified and fascinated you are with the wrinkles on your face and the wrinkles on the faces of your friends and family of your generation. Mm-hmm. You've also been doing, I think they're charcoal sketches of people, returning to your early work. I mean, you used to be a painter before you were a sculptor. Is that the reason why you've been returning to a two-dimensional form, to sketching, so that you can capture those facial details?
Absolutely true. These new drawings are about my fascination with heads and faces and hands. I've been using that euphemism, I'm middle-aging. For heaven's sakes, I'm 73. I had drawn a lot years ago. I had stopped drawing once I started getting very involved in making sculptured environments. Now, I'm making oversized heads, drawings of heads that into which I can dig. And again, you know, it's this hunger to embrace all these contradictions. I want to make them as abstract as I can in structure. I want them to be psychologically truthful in revealing the attitudes of my friends. I'm simply trying to hack out an embrace of all these contradictory factors that I'd like to put together to indicate 3 minutes of experience.
Are you particularly interested in how your face is changing with age and the faces of the people who you know best, how their faces are changing too? Because it's just like inflicted on you. I mean, it's not about anything that you're doing. It's just, you know, changes of age, and it just happens. You wake up and you look different than you did 2 weeks before, maybe. Does that have anything to do with it? That sense that it's just kind of happening to you? You're being acted upon by some force of nature?
Some force of nature?
No, do you know what I mean, though? It's out of your control.
Strange you should say that. That's the essence of what we're talking about, I think.
Because you didn't used to be that interested in faces. I mean, there really weren't facial details in your plaster sculptures. And
quite so.
And certainly you didn't do, like, intimate self-portraits of yourself earlier on, to my knowledge.
Again, quite true. Again, quite true.
So how does it feel to you at this stage of your career in your 70s to start doing more realistic self-portraits?
Depends on your definition of realism. Very strange. How do I say it? When Jackson Pollock first started throwing paint, he was accused by people who were disturbed by the lack of resemblance to nature, the real world, in the paintings. And Pollock, you know, stood erectly and insisted, "I am nature." And I burst out laughing when I heard that remark, and I had this instant vision in my head that I was standing behind Pollock while he was throwing paint. He was wearing suntan pants for some reason. Maybe it has to do with the gap, I don't know. But he was not wearing a shirt, and while he was throwing paint, I was watching the muscles on his back and his arms working. I need that kind of realism. I also need the realism of what's going on in your head. How does an artist make concrete all that invisible stuff that all of us have inside our heads? And what one artist will call realism, another someone else will call the essence of an idea.
My guest is sculptor George Siegel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is artist George Siegel. A traveling retrospective of his work is at the Jewish Museum in New York. You grew up, let me see if I have this straight. You were born in the Bronx and then moved to New Jersey, where your father bought a chicken farm?
Yeah, yeah. And you say that with a question mark.
Right, I want to make sure I'm right about this.
Yeah, yeah.
So your father had a chicken farm in New Jersey, and the butcher shop that he had came before or after the chicken farm?
A butcher shop came before.
Came before the chicken farm.
Yeah, my father assured me, he said, "You'll never make a living as an artist." At the time, he said it was true. And people always have to eat. And the crowning irony was I started going bankrupt on my own chicken farm. I learned chicken farming from my father. I studied art in school, but I did listen to the extent where I majored in art education. I got that degree that allowed me to teach. started going bankrupt on my chickens and started selling my art.
Although you abandoned the chicken farming, you kept the farm, I believe, and turned the chicken coops into your studios.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
So your chicken farm must be filled with very rich memories.
It's also filled with sculpture. It's sculpture I couldn't sell, and some sculpture I insisted on keeping. But I won't tell you which is which.
Fair enough. And I think you also used your chicken farm as a site for one of the early happenings in the late 50s, one organized by your friend Alan Caprow.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What was that like? What was the happening like?
Capra lived down the road from me, about 2 miles away, and we live in a country. He found a farmer who brought 4 tons of hay in bales that was stacked on a piece of bare ground. He wanted to rent a bulldozer to face an army of grown people and children armed with sticks from the woods. And first time in my life I ever censored an art event. I said, "Had you ever driven a bulldozer before?" He said, "No." And I said, "If your foot slips, we have some dead people." So he got a row of cars to battle the army of people and sticks. It was like that. Lucinda Childs and Yvonne Rainer danced on the roof. Lamont Young and his wife Marion played on their instruments. It was intensely interesting.
Who had to clean up afterwards?
Everybody did their own cleanup. It was remarkable. You know, the art world was very small, and about 400 people were there, and everybody picked up after themselves. It was quite astonishing. Listen, the art world, when it began in those years, was the last refuge for idealists.
What have you been able to use from your knowledge of chicken farming and apply to your art? Anything?
Well, I used to hate the chickens. They were cannibals, and they're vicious with each other, but I love the building. I learned plumbing, carpentry, electricity, cement work. I learned all those things building my own place, which stands me in good stead as a sculptor.
Do you eat much chicken now?
Only when I'm forced.
Really? You had it with chickens a long time ago.
For reasons I don't understand, my wife still loves to eat them. I love to avoid them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Siegel, the retrospective of his work is at the Jewish Museum in New York through October 4th. It opens at the Miami Art Museum in December. The catalog is published by the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, which originated the show.